Well, by way of introduction, when we think of the subject of friendships, you know, how is it that friendships really work? You look at people and you see that they have really good friendships. At the same time, you look at yourself and you go, doesn't seem like they're working all that well. Why is it that my friendships have been on life support for a really long time? They're not dead. They're just kind of coasting. Is it really even that important that I try and get my friendships together with other people? And really, where does God fit into this entire picture? I've heard people say, well, you know, you really need God at the center of your friendships. Why? Why do I need God in the center? And specifically, what role does he play? Well, we're going to be looking at this as we study the subject of friendship between David and Jonathan. Well, we pick up in verse 1, after David had finished talking with Saul, this was right after the death of Goliath, the Philistine, in chapter 17, and Jonathan apparently was listening to the entire thing. Saul is asking him, where are you from? What did you do? Well, I used to fight bears and lions and protect the sheep, and God would empower me to do this. And all of a sudden, you know, Jonathan is going, whoa, this guy is a kindred spirit. He is a warrior, but like me, he's not just some, you know, tough warrior. He's actually empowered by God. And Jonathan starts to listen in and he starts to hear all these different stories. And we read, Jonathan became one spirit with David and he loved him as he loved himself. This is something that we see as a repeated refrain throughout this narrative. One spirit, what does that mean? This similar expression is used between Jacob, the father of Benjamin, the same love that a father would have for his son is the same sort of familial love and closeness between these two friends. We read that Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as he loved himself. What is this covenant that is being described here? Well, this term covenant is used throughout the Bible. And specifically, it's used to describe two political parties coming together to make a political, legal agreement. So, in this book, the books of 1 and 2 Samuel, we see that when the men of the Ammonites come to Jabesh, they want to make a covenant. Remember that scene? But they said, we'll make an agreement that you can go free as long as you pluck out your eye. Yeah, remember, it's like Rocket the Raccoon from Guardians of the Galaxy. Yeah, we just want your eyeball, you know. That was the covenant, the agreement they were going to make. Well, this is the same thing here between David and Jonathan. Jonathan is handing over the kingship. He's seeing David. Now, how does he know to do this? He knows precisely because Samuel the prophet had spoken to Saul, and he said to Saul, because you haven't obeyed, the Lord is going to rip the kingdom away from you. And Jonathan is the heir to the throne. So it would be very important for him to know this material, that they're going to lose the kingdom. He's not going to be king. So Jonathan is looking for the next heir to the throne. And all of a sudden, we see this young, ruddy-cheeked, you know, stud, David, come on the scene, throws one rock, takes down a 9-foot-tall Goliath, and he's saying, I already know. You're going to be the king. So he's handing over the kingdom to David, and David, in a reciprocal fashion, is agreeing that he's going to make a nonviolent transfer of power. As it turns out, it's very violent. But not because of David. David doesn't kill off all of Saul's men or kill off Jonathan, anything like that. Instead, what we see is that David protects Jonathan's family even though they could be political rivals. So Jonathan's saying, you're going to get the throne, and David's saying, I'm going to protect you. How do we know this? Verse 4, the context tells us, Jonathan took off the royal robe he was wearing, and he gave it to David, along with his tunic and even his sword and his bow and his belt. He doesn't strip buck naked or anything. What's this all about? He's showing that you're going to be the king. He's putting the kingly robe around him. This is theater. This is symbolism, saying you're the next in line here. Well, we flash back to King Saul. Whatever mission the King Saul sent him on, David was so successful that King Saul gave him a high rank in the army. displeased all the troops and all Saul's officers as well. I bet they loved this, having a guy like David at the helm. When the men were returning home after David had killed Goliath the Philistine, the women came rushing out from all of the towns of Israel to meet King Saul with singing and dancing, with joyful songs and with timbrels and lyres. They're so excited to have dad back, to have their boyfriend back, to have their brother back, to have their husband back. Maybe not in that order, but they're happy to have all the men back in the city. And they start to sing. This is very common. And the first line is, Saul has slain his thousands. And Saul is listening to this song. And he's just going, I love this song. God, do I love this song. Yes, I have slain my thousands. But then they keep singing. And David, his tens of thousands. See, thousand seems pretty good until all of a sudden it's 10 times as much for this young upstart, David. At this point, Saul is very angry. This refrain displeased him greatly. I mean, this is going to the top of the charts, this song about David. And every time it's sung, it's Saul is thousands, David is 10,000s. David is 10,000, Saul is thousands. Saul is a weakling, David is a warrior. And so he's just hearing this all the time. They're all singing this, and it really pissed him off. They have credited David with tens of thousands, he thought, but me with only thousands. What more can he get but the kingdom? Foreshadowing. That's what they call that in literature, foreshadowing. And from that time on, Saul kept a close eye on David. He too heard from the prophet Samuel, the kingdom is going to be ripped from you. And so he too is looking, who is going to be the young guy? Who's going to take my place? I'm going to watch David. Well, he comes up with a plan. This is just unfathomable. First, he comes in and he just says, you know, I'm going to kill David myself. That's what I need to do. So the next day, an evil spirit from God came forcefully on Saul. Whoa, that came out of left field. God sends evil spirits. Yes, this was an act of judgment. It's not that God causes evil, nothing like that. God is judging Saul. Why? Because the prophet Samuel had said to Saul, your rebellion against me is like the sin of witchcraft and divination. So he sends an evil spirit as a form of judgment. Well, Saul was prophesying in his house while David was playing the lyre, as he usually did. And Saul had a spear in his hand, and he hurled it, saying to himself, I'll pin David right to that wall. But David eluded him, and here's the best part, twice. He could dodge, dip, dive, duck, and dodge out of the way. Twice. So this is nothing short of supernatural. Or maybe Saul is just really old, weak, and just, tries to throw it at him. David's just like, okay. Saul was afraid of David. Why? He's afraid of this younger man. Why? He's insecure. Why? Because the Lord was with David, and he had departed from Saul. So he sent David away from him and gave him command over 1,000 men to get this kid out of here. And David led the troops in their campaigns. But in everything he did, he had great success because the Lord was with David. When Saul saw how successful he was, again, he was afraid of David. All Israel and all Judah loved David because he led them on their campaigns. He is going viral, absolutely viral at this point. He is on all of the front pages of the newspapers, the internet. He's right out on Front Street. Men want to be David. Women want to be with David. This is just incredible here, what we're seeing. And Saul, the insecure leader, is sitting there thinking, how do I bump this guy off? So he says, okay, I tried to kill him. I couldn't do that. He's too quick. So he tries kind of an indirect method through his daughter. Saul says to David, he says, here is my oldest daughter, Merab. Isn't she beautiful? Isn't she good looking? Isn't she great? Isn't she wonderful? Merab, what do you think? Merab. I will give her to you in marriage if you serve me bravely and fight the battles of the Lord. Now, hold on a second. He's already been doing this. Like a lot. Like a whole lot. Like, remember that time he killed that 9-foot-tall guy, Goliath? Yeah, I'll give my daughter to you if you actually do some work around here. For Saul said to himself, I will not have to raise a hand against David. Let the Philistines do that. Saul was so sick and twisted, he thought, if I could just send David into war, he would go into war and then he would be killed and then it wouldn't even look like it was my fault. If you're a Bible reader, you see that somebody else picked up on this very strategy. It was David. He picked up on the strategy. You're right. We'll get there later. Okay. Let the Philistines do that. Well, David said to Saul, now see, this was very enticing to David because David was a shepherd boy. He came from a poor family. He's the runt of the litter. He's the youngest. He doesn't have the dowry to give to a king for a princess. He can't afford this wedding. So he can't do this. And so this was very enticing. If you go out and you do some fighting, you kill some Philistines, I'll give you my daughter. You'll be in the dynastic line, so to speak. But David said to Saul, who am I and what is my family or my clan that I should become the king's son-in-law? I'm not cut out to be around here. I don't know the etiquette. I don't know what it's like to be a king. So when the time came for Merab, Saul's daughter, to be given to David, she was given in marriage to Adriel, some other guy. So Saul didn't see this coming. He thought if he could just kind of put the Twinkie out there to get some bait for David to come in, he just thought for sure if he gives him the idea of, just grandiose royalty and wealth and fame and self-aggrandizement, it would be like the matador's cape. Why didn't Saul see that David would turn this down? Because in the mind of a man like Saul, you think that everyone is motivated by the things that motivate you. He never thought that David wouldn't be motivated by this whole idea of being the big deal in Israel. In fact, he's kept a very level head despite his fame. That didn't work, so we're going to send in a second daughter to indirectly kill David. Saul's daughter, Michal, was in love with David. And when they told Saul about it, he was very pleased, happy to hear that. Michal likes David. Okay, we're in business. I will give Michal to David, he thought, so that she may be a snare to him. This word in Hebrew is only used 3 other times in the Hebrew Bible. Every single time it is used for idol worship. That my daughter is going to be used like an idol, a snare in David's life. So that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. Again, he wants to get the Philistines to kill him. So Saul said to David, now you have a second opportunity to become my son-in-law. Do not pass this up. Saul ordered his attendants to go speak to David. So this whole communique happens through these attendants that go and talk and go back and forth to negotiate this future wedding. Speak to David privately and say, look, the king likes you a lot. And his attendants all love you. Now just become his son-in-law. Come on. But David said, do you think it is a small matter to become the king's son-in-law? I'm only a poor man and I'm little known. Everyone in Israel loves this guy. But his humility, he has kept a level head. He hasn't let his head just fill up with pride. Well, Saul replied to the attendants, say to David, the king wants no other price for the bride than 100 Philistine foreskins. You guys know what a foreskin is? I brought a video to show what this actually looks like here. We play the video. I'm just kidding. I did not bring a video. Who would bring a video of a foreskin? No one would do that. I would not do that. Anyways, you can go home and Google it. Don't Google it. Talk to your mother later about this. 100 Philistine foreskins to take revenge on his enemies. So Saul's plan was to have David fall by the hands of the Philistines, not just to kill him, but actually to take this really grotesque foreskin thing and bring it back to Saul to show that he had killed all these men. Gross. Well, when the attendants told David these things, David agreed. He was pleased to become the king's son-in-law. He's like, well, I can do that. I can kill 100 Philistines, no problem. So before the allotted time elapsed, David took his men with him and they went out and killed 200 Philistines and brought back the foreskins to Saul. They counted out the full number to the king. I was reading that. I'd never seen that before. That is, okay, Saul, 197, 198, 199, 200. So anyways, now I'd like to marry your daughter. Can we do? Yeah. This is a savage time here. They counted out the number to the kings. The king might become the king's son-in-law. And Saul gave him his daughter Michal in marriage. When Saul realized that the Lord was with David and that his daughter Michal loved David, how do you think this sentence is going to end? Oh, he's a good man. Now, just to be clear, David's not some torturer or something. He's out defending the territories of Israel from these invaders who are killing, you know, the weak and the young. And so he's going out defending Israel. This is not like he's some kind of sicko or something. So he's going out there to defend, and God's with him to defend these people from these evil invaders. And he's got his daughter, he's in love with him. But Saul became even more afraid of him, and he remained his enemy the rest of his days. He can't stand David. Fear. Three times that's mentioned. Why? Because God is with him. Well, the Philistine commanders continued to go out to battle, and as often as they did, David just used to go out there and get more and more success than the rest of Saul's officers, and his name became well known. What do you do from this point? Well, you send in your top guy, which happens to be your son, Jonathan. I mean, he's a very tough man. We read in chapter 14 how he went out and he took out a whole, you know, cadre of these Philistines with him and just another guy. So he's sending in his toughest warrior, Jonathan, to go kill David. Saul told his son Jonathan and all the attendants to kill David. But Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father, and he said to him, "Let not the king do wrong to his servant David. Has he not wronged you? And what has he done? I can't read. He has not wronged you, and what has he done? What he has done has greatly benefited you."
It's been a long day, man.
He took his life in his hands when he killed Goliath, the Philistine. The Lord won a great victory for all Israel, and you saw it yourself, and you were glad. You remember that, Dad? Why then would you do wrong to this innocent man like David by killing him for no reason? He's trying to talk some sense into his conscience. Saul listened to Jonathan, and then he took this oath. Now check this out. "As surely as the Lord lives, David will not be put to death." Is he being genuine or disingenuous here? Commentators are split. They don't know if he's like, "You're right. He saved us. What's wrong with me?" Or is this just some subterfuge that he's really just trying to get Jonathan not to realize what his plan is? It seems to me human psychology would dictate that it could be a little bit of both. There's mixed motives. He's filled with jealousy and fear and anger and paranoia and everything else, and he's not sure what he's doing, but he's just trying to placate the situation. So Jonathan called David back in, and he told him the whole conversation. Things are cool with Dad, and he brought him back to Saul, and David was with Saul before. Last time David was with Saul, Saul tried to pin him to the wall with a spear. Twice. "I'm sure everything's going to be fine this time, right?" Well, he wants to kill David himself. He's like, "It didn't work before. We're going to go for round two." Once more, war broke out, and David went out and fought the Philistines. He struck them with such force that they fled. David is still serving the people. He's still serving Saul. Bravely putting his life on the line to serve, even though this man wants him killed. An evil spirit from the Lord came on Saul as he was sitting in his house with his spear in his hand. Now, what would he be doing with a spear in his hand? Like, imagine you go over to someone's house and they just have like a butcher knife that they're just holding there, you know? While David was playing the lyre, you know, he's got one eye on the strings and he's got one eye on Saul with a spear. Saul tried to pin him to the wall with a spear. Hate that. But David eluded him as Saul drove the spear into the wall. That night, David escaped. So now, Saul's like, "Okay, I can't kill him. I got to get some soldiers." He sends in a whole, you know, platoon of soldiers to go get him. David doesn't know where to go. David goes home, sees his wife. Saul sent men to David's house, and they were going to watch it and kill him in the morning. If you read the Psalms, David writes Psalm 59 at this point. The rescue is going to come in the morning. But his wife, Michal, warned him, "If you don't run for your life tonight, tomorrow, you'll be killed." So Michal let David down through a window, and he fled and escaped. Then Michal took an idol and laid it on the bed, covering it with a garment. Well, hold on a second. An idol? A teraphim? An idol? Yeah, she had idols. She was a snare to David. And she was an idol worshiper, so the old idol in the bed trick, covering it with a garment and putting some goat's hair, the old goat hair at the top of the head. When Saul sent his men to capture David, Michal said, "David's sick. Sorry, can't come in." You might be like, "That's not very realistic." Oh, yes, it is. This is the princess. You don't just push down the door of the princess. What if she goes and tells dad? And then you got to go deal with the king. So they go back to Saul. Saul hears about this. He's sick. What do you mean he's sick? Did you see him? We saw something that looked like a person in the bed. Saul sent the men back to see David, and he told them, "Bring him to me in his bed if you need to, so that I may kill him. I don't just want him sick. I want him dead sick." But when the men entered, there was the idol in the bed, and at the head was some goat's hair. Saul said to Michal, "Why did you deceive me like this and send my enemy away so that he escaped?" Michal replied, "Dad, I had to. David threatened to kill me if I didn't help him." See, Saul knew. He knew. You know, David didn't have this idol. That idol was put in there by his daughter. He knew his daughter. So why doesn't he just wipe out his daughter? Well, this is actually a very good political expedient here. If David is threatening the princess and threatening to kill her, Saul has twice the reason to take out David. And while all the people in Israel love David, once they hear this, they're going to be like, kill him. Well, this is where it gets really weird. David fled and made his escape, and he went to Samuel at Ramah in Naoth. Saul sent men to capture David. But when the soldiers saw a group of prophets in Ramah, the soldiers are walking in, they see these prophets prophesying with Samuel, the prophet, standing there as their leader. The Spirit of God came on Saul's men, and they began to prophesy, to pray. This could be speaking for God, praying, some kind of ecstatic speech, whatever it is. These guys are coming in to kill, and all of a sudden they start talking to God. What on earth? Saul was told about this. He's like, "What happened?" "Well, Your Majesty, the men you sent, they were thwarted." "How? Was it David's mighty men?" "No, Your Majesty." "Was it, you know, an ambush?" "No." "Who was there?" "Just some prophets." "Why didn't they kill him?" "Well, they started to prophesy when they got there." Saul's just like, "This, you can't make this up here. What is going on?" So he sent some more men, and they prophesied too when they got there. Saul sent men a third time. Well, these guys go in and they kill him, right? No, wrong. They also prophesied. They just keep sending wave after wave in there to go kill David. And they get there and they enter into this prayer meeting. They're just totally stopped by the Spirit of God. So Saul's like, "If you want to get something done right, you got to do it yourself. I'm going to go kill David myself." Yeah, that's worked real well the last two times. Finally, Saul himself left for Ramah. But the Spirit came even on Saul, and he walked around prophesying until he came to Naoth. So you just can't get away from this. Well, Saul stripped off his garments, and he too prophesied in Samuel's presence. He lay naked all that night and all that day. Wow. What an image there. Don't think about the image, but the imagery. So he's taking off the robe, the tunic. What's that mean? When Samuel, the prophet, said that the kingdom is going to be torn from you, this is him tearing off the royal robes. This is the imagery that Saul is going to lose his kingdom. Chapter 20, David just runs from Naoth at Ramah, and he goes and he meets up with Jonathan. Remember they said, "Things are cool with your dad, things are cool with my dad." He goes in, he tries to get speared, chases him to the house, runs off. It's a manhunt. He meets him out in the wilderness. David is understandably irate. "What have I done?" he asked. "What is my crime?" he asked. "How have I wronged your father that he's trying to kill me?" "That's not even true," Jonathan protested. "You're not going to die. My father tells me everything he's going to do, even the little things. I know he wouldn't hide something like this from me. This just isn't so." You can't, well, maybe you can pick it up in the English, but in the Hebrew, this is a fierce, angry argument. These guys are really upset with each other. David took an oath before Jonathan, and he said, "Jonathan, your father knows perfectly well about our friendship. But I swear to you that I'm only a step away from death. I swear it by the Lord and by your own soul." Jonathan exclaimed at this point, "Just tell me what I can do to help." So David sets up this plan. He says, look, you know, tomorrow is the new moon festival. He says, I'm supposed to dine with King Saul, but let me go and hide in the field until the evening of the day after tomorrow. So on the new moon festival, you could claim that you were unclean ceremonially. So don't let me show up there. I won't show up there. And then I won't show up the next day either. Now, at that point, you would know. It's Saul. You'd know. You couldn't be unclean for 2 days in a row. So David says, if your dad is really upset about this and he loses his temper at dinner on the second day, you're going to know he's still after me. And this is for you to see. I already know it, but this is a test that when I'm missing at dinner, you're going to see the true colors of your dad. So they set this up. Jonathan agrees. He goes back. So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David saying, may the Lord call David's enemies to account. And Jonathan and David reaffirm his oath out of love for him because he loved him as he loved himself. When the new moon festival came, the king sat down to eat. King Saul sat in his customary place with his back to the wall, paranoid. He's in the inner sanctum of his castle. He's safe. He always customarily put his back to the wall so no one could hurt him. He was opposite of Jonathan, his son, and Abner, his first in command, who was sitting next to him. But David's seat was empty. Saul said nothing that day. But the next day, he's starting to realize this. Okay, this is not because he's unclean. He's missing for a reason. The next day, he saw that David's place was empty again. And he turned to Jonathan and he said, Jonathan, why has the son-in-law of mine, why has your friend, the member of the royal household, no, that son of Jesse, the shepherd, you know, that gutter trash, David, this is a slip of the tongue. Why has that son of Jesse not come to the meal? He wasn't here yesterday. He wasn't here today either. Jonathan just comes out with it. David asked for permission to go to Bethlehem to offer a sacrifice. That is why he's not come to the king's table. And at that point, Saul's anger flared up at Jonathan and he exploded. You son of a perverse and rebellious woman. This is so mild from the Hebrew. The Hebrew is quite literally, you bastard or you son of a rebellious slut. Now, I'm not making that up. I'm not up here cussing. What I'm saying is that's what the Bible says. The Bible says that. I'm not a fan of bleeping out the Bible. The Bible is a rated R book, and we should read it the way it should be intended. You bastard or you son of a rebellious slut. You know, mom. Don't I know that you have sided with this son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother who bore you? As long as the son of Jesse lives on this earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Don't you see that? We're talking about your future. Can you see that David's in the way of all this? Send someone to bring David to me. He must die. To paraphrase, son, I'm trying to kill David, but can't you see this is all for you? Why should he be put to death? Jonathan asks. What has he done? And at that moment, Saul hurled his spear at Jonathan to kill him. Yeah, I'm doing this all for you, son. This is all for your dynasty. And then a minute later, he's picking up a spear trying to kill his own son. Good Lord. Jonathan knew that his father intended to kill David. Well, they go through this whole meetup. Basically, they're trying to get out into the forest, and they meet up and talk to each other. When David sees Jonathan, he can't even approach him. He just comes up to him, and he bows down 3 different times. This was a show of just complete reverence for his friend. Then they kissed each other and wept together, but David wept the most. Jonathan said to David, go in peace, for we have a sworn friendship with each other in the name of the Lord. Then David left, and Jonathan went back into town. Well, there is our narrative for the night. What is it that we can learn about friendships from this narrative between Jonathan and David? Well, let's begin with our key antagonist of the account, Saul. What do we learn about friendships from Saul? What is it that ruined Saul's relationships? Was it that he had, you know, problems with the people around him? All these people, man, these just awful people surrounding me. That's really the problem here. No, the people were great. Saul had a great kingdom. He's the first king. He's got a guy that came out of nowhere who's defending the kingdom, David. He's got great military commanders. He's got a wonderful son. That's not the people. The people are not the problem. I hope you can see that. Is the problem that the circumstances in the kingdom are bad, like the Philistines were just causing too much stress? No, that was not the problem either. It wasn't some kind of an external issue with Saul that, well, you know, I just can't handle all the stress of leading, and it just makes me have to ruin all my relationships, even with my own son. No, it wasn't that. Was it that Saul was just an old dog and you can't teach them new tricks? No, I don't believe that. I do not believe that. Yeah, people get set in their ways. That's true. God has the business, or is in the business, of pulling people out of their ways. And we saw repeatedly that this was a persistent and perpetual attack against David. This was not, oh, I just couldn't help myself. His relationships were ruined because of himself. That was the issue. Like his jealousy. Looking at a man. Now, it's easier, in my estimation, when you look at an older man, and that person is better at you at something, or they're more, you know, skilled or whatever, and you look at them and you say, well, yeah, they've had a lot more time to practice. Of course, they would do better. But how different it is to look at somebody who's a peer or someone who's a younger person. When they do a better job than you, that is the real test of humility right there. To be able to say, they're just better. I really have nothing to say. It's not that I haven't been doing this longer, and I haven't been trying. I've been putting in the effort. That is pure jealousy right there, and Saul just couldn't handle it. Insecurity was just burbling right to the top. Anger. Saul had a terrible anger issue. I mean, homicidal. That's how bad this was. And this is something to think about, really. You know, Saul's relationships were ruined. His family was ruined. His life was ruined. Why? Because he couldn't get his anger under control, and consequently, his anger controlled him. And this is something for us to ponder, I believe, because those of us here who have issues with anger, you need to get this under control. It has to stop. It must stop. To fly off the handle at your loved ones and your friends and to just let them have it makes people feel afraid, makes people feel tense around you. There's things that you say in anger that cannot be unsaid. They cannot be taken back. There are some things that you say that ought never have been said in the first place. And when you're younger, this is real cute and stuff. You know, okay, we worked through this, but, you know, it's not cute when you're 30, 40, 50, and you're still kind of a tyrant who can't control his anger. What else ruined his relationships? His fear, his insecurity. Yeah, anger is a real safe emotion when you think about it. It's really easy to get real angry at people and scare people, threaten them, be very menacing. Really, it's the sign of a very insecure person. You know, I was angry. Yes, but what were you really feeling? Well, I was really feeling threatened. I was really feeling insulted. I was really feeling demeaned, insecure, fearful. When they made that comment, it just set me off. Look, you're not a machine that people press a button and it sets you off. You are a free moral agent that has control of his anger or her anger. Same thing is true here. Yeah, he had fear and insecurity. He needed to deal with that. He needed to come to terms with that. Suspicion. Oh, was he suspicious? David trying to come and usurp the throne. He's going to lead a coup, have me killed. You know, even Jonathan, his own son, you're siding with the enemy. He calls David my enemy. Suspicion. Yeah. Boy, I struggle with this. Some days I'll just wake up in the morning and I'll have these thoughts pop into my head about what I think people are saying about me, what they're thinking about me. I'll have a bad dream. I just can't shake it, you know. Years ago, the guy who led me to Christ, pulled me out of a gutter, you know, helped me get a job. I mean, this was so humiliating. I couldn't get a job. He drove me to a store to buy pants, to have pants to go to get a job and to work. Taught me the Bible, taught me how to pray, helped me with my relational issues, my depression, my, you know. And at a certain point, I believed that this guy was out to get me. We were co-leading together one of these small Bible studies. And I believed that, you know, whenever I would suggest an idea, he would have to nitpick it. He didn't like that idea. He's always criticizing everything I was doing. And then I was asked to, you know, take different privileges to do certain ministries, and I just was sure that was just eating him right up. Because, of course, you know, I'm having all these opportunities. He's not having any of them. Well, later, the final straw broke when I was asked to come and to serve here at this church. Vocationally. I was asked to do that, and he wasn't. I thought for sure, here it is. You know, he's going to be so, this is going to estrange our relationship. I remember sitting at lunch. We were out on a vacation together, and my buddy, this real loudmouth, you know, extroverted kind of a guy, he said, I heard you're going to start working and teaching and stuff at the church. And I was just like, shut up, you know? And my buddy, I'll never forget this, he looked me right in the eye, and he said, you're kidding me. I said, no. He said, I have been telling people behind your back for years that you should have that job. That was one of those moments where you start to reflect on the relationship year after year after year after year. It wasn't that he was jealous of me. He wasn't competing with me. I was competing with him. That was what was going on. I had turned against him in my heart, and I thought that he was the one with the ego. Turns out I was the one with the ego. That is a lot of suspicion. This is the place from which it derives, ego. Tears were shed, I can assure you. Well, we've made up since then. We're real close now. But at the time, I was very ashamed of myself. Well, what about David and Jonathan? Let's get to the good part here. This is the good stuff. Forget Saul. Both put God first. That is the key to a good friendship. You know, what did they have in common? Not much. I mean, they're both soldiers. They're warriors. So I guess they could share some battle stories or whatever. But beyond that, what do they have in common? David's the youngest. Jonathan's the oldest. David's poor. Jonathan's rich. David's from that side of the tracks. Jonathan's from that side of the track. I mean, they had nothing in common except God. And if you have God at the center of your relationships, it's kind of like this. It's kind of like, you know, if you have two people that are really separated, but they're both trying to pursue God together. The closer that the one gets to God, the closer that the other gets to God too. So too, the closer they get to each other. If we're both going to the same reference point, we're getting closer by proxy. So we keep doing this over years and years, and we see the same thing over and over. When you have God at the center and you're both moving toward him, that is a stable foundation right there. A stable foundation is the infinite personal God. If you put anything else in the center of your relationships, you know, fantasy football, that's going to be the thing. You know, drugs, what do we do together? We get drunk, we get hammered. That's the thing that's keeping your friendship together. Very shaky, very shaky. I know I used to have a lot of laughs. You know, we get high, we watch, you know, The Big Lebowski for the 100th time together, you know. We would go to the, whatever. We, you know, go to parties and stuff and get in a lot of trouble. And that was like a friendship. When I came to Christ and I left that perspective and I'm like, you know, I really don't want that in my life anymore, I realized that those relationships were just totally superficial. It's like, what do we talk about? We're not high. We're not drunk. We're not doing something stupid. But when the two of you are both moving toward God, all of a sudden, this is where relationships become strong. So they put God first. That is where it all begins. That's the key to a good friendship. It's not just that we're goofing around. I mean, we do a lot of that too. But when we have a mission together and we're doing that together, that is what brings people together. They also put the other person first. What do we keep reading in this narrative? He loved him as he loved himself. Jonathan loved David as he, you see, Jonathan had the most to gain from David's death. He could have had him killed and he would have slid right into the kingship. Instead, Jonathan ended up giving up his life for the sake of David. We'll read at the end of this book, chapter 31, verses 1 and 2, that Jonathan ends up being killed by none other than the Philistines. And David survives to take over the throne. Putting the other person first. both expressed love for each other. I know we read some of those passages, you know, they were, you know, hugging each other, kissing each other. This is on the cheek, okay? This is the way people are in the rest of the world. The rest of the world looks at us and they think we're weird. I remember traveling over to Cambodia. We were taking a picture on the final day and one of the guys there, you know, we're arms around each other. This is cool. This guy, he put his arm around me and then he put it down like, you know, on my side or whatever. I was like, yeah, you know. Then he kind of slid that arm down a little bit further. And I was like, kind of tightened up a little bit. And then he actually just put it right on my butt. That's the way it is. You'd see men and women walking down the street holding hands. This is just the way it was. So I don't know in our culture, I'm not into the hugging and kissing thing with anyone besides my kids, my wife, but showing, expressing your love. Well, he knows I love him. She knows I love her. No, she doesn't. No, he doesn't. You haven't expressed it. You haven't shared it. How are they supposed to know unless you share it with them? They were honest with each other. They fought. They fought. Remember that scene? Your dad's trying to kill me. What have I done? That never happened. They really had it out with each other. This isn't the sign of a bad friendship. Actually, the sign of a bad friendship is where there's no relational tension whatsoever. That's what they call peace faking, where you're faking that we're all good and actually you're not. Finally, both believed in what the other could become. I remember there was a woman, older woman. She was really old. She was like 32, okay? I was young. I was like 21. And I was sent in to have this conversation with this guy, kind of a tense conversation. I really needed to speak the truth in love, but it was very tense. It took a lot of courage. And I went in there and did it, and I just didn't feel that good about it. This woman came in, she said, "Man, James, the way you handled that conversation, you really reminded me of this one guy that's in our church. You wouldn't know him, but a guy I really looked up to." And I never had viewed myself in that way, you know what I mean? But then she had that one word to say. She doesn't even remember saying it. That was 15 years ago. And now, years later, that changed the entire course of my life. You know, I always felt like I could do something for the Lord. I didn't know if it would be any good, but I felt like I could make a contribution. But I looked at my life and I just saw, man, there's sin. Man, there's problems. I had issues up and down. But I always felt like I could do something if I just had one person who believed in me. I hope you have people that believe in you, and I hope that you have people whom you believe in as well.